Welcome to the program. The state of California was once a model of governance, creativity, and innovation. In Joan Didion's words, it was once a place where the dream was teaching the dreamers how to live. Today it is a state in crisis, a government and an infrastructure arguably beyond repair, a political system paralyzed by partisan gridlock, and the corruption of self-serving public employee unions. Yet when we look at the origins of the crisis, it's fair to say we have met the enemy, and he is us. We're going to talk about all of this today with two veteran California journalists. I'm joined this morning by Joe Matthews. He's an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation. He's the author of the previous book, The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. And Mark Paul, who is a senior scholar and deputy director of the California Program at the New American Foundation. Together, they're the co-authors of California Crack Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How We Can Fix It. Joe Matthews, Mark Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
It's great to be with you. Great to have you here. Joe, let's start with you. How did we get to this point? This isn't something that happened overnight. Before we talk about what we can possibly do to deal with this, talk a little bit about the history as you see it that has led us to this mess we're in today.
Well, California's, in essence, has had a 160-year adolescence. You know, this is a state that has a very peculiar history, a history of, you know, of sort of lots of very fast, sudden growth that has allowed us to get away with the fact that we've never had a particularly coherent system of government. We never had a real founding of the state. You know, we were a pretty empty place, and there was a gold rush, and suddenly we were a state. Our original constitution was essentially a pretty defective document, a very cheap, slapdash copy of the Iowa Constitution, which at the time was sort of adopted because we plagiarized from way back when because it was very short and it had been recently passed. And then we've had, you know, we had a big constitutional convention 30 years in the history of the state, in 1878 and 1879, that was something of a civic disaster. Became dominated by San Francisco, you know, labor interests that were, you know, most dedicated to discrimination against the Chinese. And since then, we've really had a series of different improvisations, you know, fueled by the introduction of direct democracy, initiative, and referendum in 1911. And, you know, we're now, I think, you know, we've had these sort of series of waves and improvisations within these waves, and a real tendency to search out what, you know, the writer Kerry McWilliams called the, you know, perilous remedies for present evils. And we're kind of in the fifth wave of these improvisations, which started in 1978 with Prop 13. And in this way, we really tried to lock a lot of things in to our Constitution that don't belong there. And in doing so, we've made it, you know, very, very difficult for the people we elect to office to govern, and we've even made it difficult for ourselves as voters to get what we want. And ultimately, we've got a system that doesn't work because it's got too many sort of chains and you know, gimmicks in it that you know, prevent us from, you know, simply making decisions in a timely democratic way.
Mark, one of the things that's certainly preventing us from sweeping some of these problems under the rug yet again are the economic crises and the economic forces that are at play right now. Are there any historical parallels to economic problems that have faced California that have resulted in the kind of political paralysis that we're seeing today?
Well, we have gone through these economic crises in the past, and in fact, some of the restraints that Joe talked about are the result of those crises, some unintended. For instance, back in the Great Depression in California, California, like lots of other states, was finding it unable to do its budgets, et cetera. And that, it was in 1933, for instance, that we adopted for the first time the two-thirds requirement for passing a budget and spending bills, although when it was in 1933, the original one was only a two-thirds requirement when the budget increased by more than 5% from budget to budget. So that was in that crisis you saw the the beginning of the imposition of fiscal restraints, and it was hardly discussed at the time because it was part of a larger package dealing with trying to get through a budget crisis. And as Joe said, that's our tendency. We tend to, in perilous times, to adopt perilous remedies with little thought to how they are going to affect overall governance in the whole structure.
And is that because of the referendum process, or is there something else in the California political DNA that keeps causing us to do that repeatedly?
Wow. I think it's partly the kind of initiative process that we have that is partly to blame. We have a very inflexible initiative process. Everywhere else in the world that has initiative, and it's actually a surprisingly large number of countries, and it's nearly half of the U.S. states. They permit a larger role for the legislature than we do. They let the legislature. Everyone else lets the legislature amend an initiative statute. We don't. Most places have a real role for the legislature. There's flexibility in changing a measure, and the legislature can weigh in on it first in a formal way. We don't do that. And so that makes the things we do at the ballot unusually sticky and unusually hard to change. If you want to do anything with the lottery in this state, you essentially have to go back to the ballot. Because it was originally passed by voters. If you want to do anything in the policy that governs chiropractors, you have to go back to the ballot because it was passed by voters. I mean, those are perhaps smaller examples, but it we also make it fairly easy to change the Constitution, via the initiative process, and much easier to change the Constitution than in a lot of places. So it really allows, previous generations to sort of bake into the governing document and to make, fix things that future generations have to live with in a profound way. I'm not sure that, maybe there's something deep in the California character that we're a little bit utopian or we're a little bit impatient, which is probably there'd be a strong case for that in our history. But maybe that combination of that impatience with a very sticky initiative process is, you could say, is a pretty dangerous one.
And I might add, Jeff, that I think the other thing that's not a character, but it is that we're a very large physically state, and we've also been a very diverse state. If you think about most other states, they tend to be dominated by a single metropolitan area. In California, we have this huge expanse of land and different ecosystems and environments and climate zones. And so I think part of the reason we have some of these difficulties is that we're so big and diverse, and that we have a governance system that has never really been set up to take into account that we are what we describe in the book is in some ways a nation without states.
Mm-hmm.
That we govern, particularly after the Prop 13 centralized all the power in Sacramento, we try to govern from the center, a place that's not easily governed and that ought to have more power at the local level.
Every conversation about the state we're in California right now at some point circles back to the issue of Prop 13. Mark, talk a little bit about that and how central it really is to some of these issues that we're discussing.
Well, it is very central, but not in the way we usually talk about Proposition 13. For most Californians, the Proposition 13 begins and ends with the protections for homeowners against rising property tax rates and assessments. And that is not really the key here, the effect of Prop 13, because Prop 13 actually had two other central provisions. One was is that it, when it capped property tax rates, it created a new system in which the legislature was given the authority for dividing up the remaining property tax among local governments. And so it shifted power explicitly to Sacramento and to the legislature, and to give them, the legislators, to make decisions that used to be made in city councils and county boards of supervisors in school districts. And the other thing it did at the same time is it created the two-thirds requirement for a two-thirds vote to pass any tax increase. So at the same time as it gave the legislature more power, it also made it more difficult for the legislature to act. It's created a system, you know, for instance, in the book we note that even though California's population has not quite doubled since Prop 13 is passed, we have now five times more lobbyists in Sacramento, spending 10 times as much money. Sacramento has become the pit in which all of our arguments in California get decided, with the focus of all this special interest attention and money. But at the same time, we put all these restraints on the legislature. It's, you know, we say in the book, it's a system that doesn't work because it can't work.
And to what extent, Joe, has all of that been exacerbated, everything that Mark was just talking about, exacerbated by term limits?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a very long discussion and question. I think it certainly made it harder. It takes a long time to learn how to legislate. It's an art, not a science, and particularly the short-term limits we have in California, 6 years in the Assembly and 8 years in the State Senate, make it very hard for even the people with the best of intentions to really know what they're doing. It was a great book that we write about in the book that was based on by a fellow named Sandy Muir. He was a longtime political scientist at Berkeley, definitely a right-of-center person, who actually wrote about the legislature. He called it California School for Politics. The book's 30 years old, and based on research he did 35 years ago when he actually went to work for 2 years in the legislature. And, you know, he really describes the process of making change as a very much a piecemeal process, a process that takes years to get things right. You tweak legislation one way, you tweak it another, you test, you probe, you see the real world results. And, you know, the process of making major legislative change, in his view, takes, you know, a decade or more. Well, you don't have a decade in the House of a legislature to do it. And it focuses us, you know, our elected representatives very much on the short term, when, you know, we really should be thinking more about the long term.
How has, for either one of you, how has the hyper-partisanship that has become so much of our politics at every level today, how has that further exacerbated some of these problems?
Well, it makes obviously more difficult to reach a two-thirds majority. That's one of the oddities of our system is that among political scientists, you know, we think about our legislative system in which we elect people by single member districts and plurality, you know, elections where the person with the most votes wins, whether it's a majority or not. Political scientists think of that as a system for creating strong majorities. In fact, it exaggerates the power, the strength of majority parties in legislatures. But then we have the second system that governs everything dealing with fiscal policy. You have to have two-thirds votes for budgets and for taxes and for spending bills and to change the school funding guarantee and a lot of things dealing with transportation and the like. And so that's a system that political scientists talk about as a system of consensus. Well, you know, we have moved toward that more consensus-based system with the two-thirds rules at the very time that our politics underneath was changing to create a more polarization between the parties. So those two are in tension. And in fact, I think it actually exacerbates in California the partisanship because, particularly, you know, as Republicans have moved over the last 20 or 30 years to make taxes sort of the central glue of the Republican Party in opposition to taxes as the central glue of the Republican Party, they can achieve that goal by winning only one-third of one house of the legislature. And so the system, as we say in the book, in some ways, you know, encourages Republicans to be more extreme because they get rewarded whether they win elections or not, and sort of their embrace of the two-thirds rules is something, you know, that we say in the book is they're in love with what keeps them in political prison, because in the absence of the two-thirds rule, I think the Republicans would have to reach out and try to win elections, and they'd broaden their appeal, and I think both parties would be less polarized if we didn't have the two-thirds.
Joe, how do we begin to reshape the architecture of our politics in California to even begin to address some of these issues?
Well, I mean, I let me answer that and also your previous question. We don't in this book propose a solution to partisanship and the real sort of polarized parties of today, in part because I don't think there is one. You know, that's the reality that we have. What we really propose is to redesign a system in a way that reflects that reality and harnesses the energy of that reality into a sort of more, you know, kind of timely, coherent, democratic, small d governance. And, you know, we essentially have, we see this as, you know, this, the problem California system is fundamentally the fact that it has three systems in opposition. You know, as Mark talked about, a majoritarian election system, this consensus-based two-thirds system for big legislative issues, particularly the fiscal ones, and this very sticky, inflexible initiative process. And what you have to do is sort of integrate those three together. And, you know, the political reality is that to do that, you have to fix the election system. You begin with the election system first. And the way you do that is try to create, you know, election systems that really allow for accountability, allow for the majority party to lose, the minority party to become the majority party, which is not something that has happened very often in the last generation and a half in California. We're really stuck where we are, and you do that by giving, you know, creating a system where every vote actually counts. And where the elections take place in ways that they're easy for people to follow and easy for the media to scrutinize. And what we propose in the book specifically is sort of multi-member districts. We have single-member, first-past-the-post elections in the state, as we do in you know, throughout this country. And we suggest multi-member districts, I think, you know, loosely based, you know, that, you know, of the main regions of the state, where some of the seats would be apportioned by proportional representation, the proportion that one, you know, party gets of the votes would reflect how many seats they get, and that creates competition everywhere across the state. I mean, the sorts of things that people say redistricting or open primary will do and won't really do, unfortunately, happen in that system. You get competition in every place. You get representation. I mean, even a Bay Area district. You know, right now the Bay Area is represented entirely by Democrats, even though there are a lot of Republicans there. There would probably be a few Republicans from the Bay Area. And you'd have people compete for every vote, because in a proportional system, you know, a party needs to compete for every vote everywhere, because it needs to run up the score as much as possible. Whether it's a place where that party is very strong or that, you know, it's a place where that party is very weak. And if you do that and make some other changes, you know, we argue for making the legislature bigger in terms of the number of people, because we have the largest districts by far in the country, which means that, you know, our representatives in California really represent too many people, far more people, three times mm-hmm. as many people as in any other state. If you do that and you have a legislature that has credibility, that people feel like they can elect and change, then you can move into these sort of second and third pieces, where you strip out all these whips and chains and two-thirds supermajorities
that restrict the legislature. You have the credibility of an elected, of a democratically elected legislature that feels democratically elected. So you can make those changes, and then you can change the initiative process as well, to, in a way that, makes it, that allows the legislature to amend initiatives, but also we suggest, gives the public, greater power to use the referendum tool, the ability to reverse a legislative act, to as a check on the legislature. That's essentially our program in a very short way.
Talk about that last part of it, particularly with respect to the initiative process, because on the one hand you're saying more direct democracy and yet talking about the problems inherent in the initiative process that we already have.
Well, I mean, this, for one thing, California has a now 99-year-old tradition of direct democracy at the state level. People like having the ability to vote on big issues, and I don't think that's going to be changed. I myself am sympathetic to direct democracy when practiced well. It is not practiced well in California. And when you look at, it is practiced in other states and around the world. And again, as I said, we have this very inflexible initiative process, which no one else has. Most other places have a greater role for the legislative in the legislature in the process. And we suggest that the way to reform direct democracy and actually make it more direct, more of a direct interplay and direct judgment by the people on the government, is to give, paradoxically, give the legislature the ability to play in the process, both after in terms of being able to amend things that the people do more easily, but also before, so that there's more of a negotiation between the sponsor and the legislature. And if they can reach an agreement, it's easy to, we should make it easier to pull things off the ballot. Right now, it's very inflexible. Once you've filed your signatures and you've qualified, you're on the ballot no matter what. We've got to change that. And then if the legislature and initiative sponsor don't reach agreement, we allow for a counter proposal, which is the way they do it in Switzerland and Germany, which is instead of just seeing an initiative on the ballot, you get three questions. The initiative, yes or no. A legislative counterproposal right on the ballot next to it, yes or no. And then a third question, if both of these pass, which do you prefer? Which allows the folks who oppose both to express their view, the lesser of the evils. And there's a lot more choice in that. I think there's a better campaign when you have that kind of structure, mm-hmm. because you, instead of having one initiative that's drafted by some lawyer or some interest group or some rich person, and you have an argument about the emotion around the issue, when you have, an initiative and a legislative counterproposal, you have a comparative campaign where the natural thing to do is to actually get into the details of the two measures and see what it is that makes them different. That's a much healthier campaign, is going to produce a, more informed public when they go to the polls. They actually know what's in the details and might ferret out, unintended consequences in that kind of campaign.
Mark, what, if anything, is the role of local and municipal government in moving us forward at this point and trying to break some of the deadlocks that we see?
Well, I think that the biggest role is for people elected in cities and counties and school districts to become the advanced guard of the kind of changes we need, because I think they understand better than anybody that the system is broken in California, and I think they also understand that they are in an untenable position, because we've really turned local governments to a considerable extent just into one purpose spending agencies, because they have so little control over own revenues, and also we have the other thing that they understand is that we've split the responsibility for running programs and the responsibility for spending them in ways that prevent us from adopting smart policies. We talk in the book some, for instance, about the use the example of the criminal justice system, which is second only to education as a spending item in state government. But we have the responsibility divvied and the funding funding decisions divvied up among cities and counties, and then the state with prisons. And we've ended up with a system in which we're spending huge amounts of money on prisons, and particularly huge amounts of that on prisoners who are older and who are beyond their crime years. But at the same time, today in California, we're laying off police all over the state of California. In fact, you know, in the Bay Area, the city of San Carlos just abolished its police department. The criminal justice experts will say that it doesn't make sense to be spending all our money on the back end on people who committed crimes long ago. We ought to be spending more of our money on preventing crimes. The system doesn't allow that right now.
And Joe, talk about what happens if we continue on the same path that we're on. How bad can this get?
You know, I don't know. I honestly don't know how bad it can get. I was a reporter for the LA Times. Covered Governor Schwarzenegger. Wrote about state issues, and I'm surprised that things got this bad. I honestly thought that maybe it's a product of youth, but I honestly thought that if before things got as bad as they got with some of the cuts we've seen, that you would have seen compromise, and particularly probably more on the Republican side, a willingness to raise revenues, and a willingness for Democrats to consider some pretty different ideas that made them uncomfortable. But I'm just sort of stunned by how the political conversation has not changed. I mean, you look at the two people running for governor and the things they're saying, and it could be 2006 or 2002 to listen mm-hmm. to them. They're saying all the same things, telling all the same sort of old stories about California politics that just simply aren't true anymore. And I think each of them are doing a profound disservice to the state by sort of telling these old, same hackneyed stories, which are really misleading folks about the nature of the problem we face. And particularly when we do a lot of blame, we're blaming a specific governor, a specific legislator, a specific party, a specific interest group, whether it's a corporation or a union. I mean, this is a situation where we all share blame, and it involves big systemic changes. I mean, the other sort of, I think the big lie of this is that, I'm guilty of this. I'm a reporter and, it's fetish, bipartisanship and incrementalism is sort of the way politics works. And I think that's true most of the time, but it's not true in this situation. Incrementalism will not get us out of this. In fact, it's sort of our California-style incrementalism that has gotten us into this mess. We actually need big, bold, constitutional change that requires a constitutional revision, perhaps through a commission or through a, goodness gracious, a constitutional convention.
But, of course, what that requires, and it sort of comes back to the point that you just made, which is the lack of leadership. When we see even these budget stalemates that go on for months and months and months and months, it is remarkable that out of that there does not emerge a single member, Republican or Democrat, that comes forward with any kind of creative ideas or anything that even smacks of leadership.
Well, I think that's a little unfair. I mean, in the legislature, for instance, there were people that when the Bay Area Council 2 years ago began a push for a constitutional convention, there were members of the legislature like Mark DeSalle in the Senate from Contra Costa County, even Sam Blakesley, who won yesterday in the special election in the Central mm-hmm. Coast, was talking about the necessity for big changes. So there were people, but the failure is not just in the leadership. And Jeff, the failure really is in us. It's democracy is one of the synonyms is self-government, and there's not a lot of self-government in California. That Californians are easily express their disgust with what's going on. They the legislature's ratings are the lowest they've ever been. Arnold Schwarzenegger's approval rating is now at the same level as when Gray Davis's was when he was recalled. Voters easily express their disgust, but they don't get out and get involved. This is self-government. People need to learn what are the issues here and recognize that the interest groups which dominate politics all have a lot of hostages in this Constitution and are so far not willing to, don't think things are bad enough that they risk giving up any of those hostages. It really is going to take a people's movement, as there was with the progressives a century ago that gave us the initiative in the first place, and the people's movement that brought Prop 13, which was, you know, was, we argue in the book, flawed in many ways, but nevertheless accomplished, you know, a very important thing, which is to protect homeowners at a time when the politicians were unable to do it.
Joe, last word to that same point?
I think Mark is right, and, you know, but the public has really batted down people who have tried to sort of step out and lead. The example both Mark and I often use is the example of February 2009, where you had, you know, legislative leaders and a handful of Republicans make a very difficult deal, and because of our inflexible initiative process, they had to, you know, that budget deal had five different pieces that had to go up on the ballot in the May 2009 special election. And remember, this is after, you know, November 2008, we elected a Democratic legislature. That legislature, because of our two-thirds system, had to then go and negotiate with the Republican minority. It just had beaten in the polls. They make this deal in February 2009, and the voters turn it down, with many people saying, why are you bothering me with this? Well, we're bothering you with this because you're the folks in charge. You're the folks who get the final say on so many things under this system. I think there's been a sort of massive, you know, shirking of responsibility by the public. Before you blame any particular person in this system, you need to get a full-length mirror and look at it. And you're probably looking at someone who shares the blame for the fix we're in.
Joe Matthews, Mark Paul, their must-read book just out from University of California Press is California Crack Up. Joe, Mark, I thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Jeff.